are now eyeing a 20-year strategic partnership treaty that would lay out the roadmap for future expansion of ties at all levels, from politics to economy and security.
This year, Tehran and Russia traded some $4 billion worth of commodities, roughly 90% up compared to last year's trade volume. Now, given the growing relationship between the two sides, the Iran-Russia Chamber of Commerce predicts that this figure will hit $10 billion by 2024. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In just the past 9 months, the EU and US have together pumped €32 billion worth of lethal weapons into Ukraine. At a meeting here in Brussels on Tuesday, EU defence ministers agreed to increase their military spending by a huge amount between now and the end of 2025.
€70 billion.
Apparently, there is an urgent need to replace weapons being sent to Ukraine.
The supply of arms to Ukraine, it's a continuous flow. It flows every day. And every day there is a member state who provides more. The system has already been provided. I don't think we need new systems. What they need is ammunition to make the systems work.
One expert we interviewed online told us it is a dangerous policy.
The problem with further funding is that it suggests further escalation. An escalation is hazardous because by intent or by miscalculation, it can lead all of the parties into a nuclear conflict.
Many peace activists and rights groups say the military spending is grotesque given the EU's growing social crisis. Those in the European Parliament who oppose NATO and are calling for peace talks between Russia and Ukraine are furious at attempts to silence them.
We talk about democracy, but where is this going to end up? Those you brand as populist and anti-European have a democratic right to disagree with you on the course that Europe is taking.
Defence ministers have agreed to establish camps in up to 20 EU nations that will be used to train Ukrainian soldiers. Some security analysts are suggesting long-standing, controversial ambitions to create an EU army within the EU have effectively been put on hold. And now the strategy is to create an EU army in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Iran insists that recent riots in the country were orchestrated by outside adversaries such as the United States. But EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels on Monday took a different view. They have agreed on new sanctions against Iran, claiming the rioters are seeking freedom.
To support them, today the Council adopted another 31 listing under the Iran human rights regime.
The channel you are watching now, Press TV, has also been added to the EU sanctions list. Press TV management has vehemently rejected claims by the EU that the channel broadcast forced confessions from detainees during recent riots in Iran. EU officials have been asked to provide evidence to back up the claims, but it's already clear that will not be forthcoming, simply because it never happened. This latest set of sanctions follows similar measures against Iran taken by the EU in October.
Iran is geographically a very strong position because they can decide, okay, if the European Union is going to make life harder in terms of sanctions, we can close or threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz. That means that Qatar, which is the principal supplier, I think about 70% of gas is coming from Qatar these days, will be stranded.
One EU minister says the new sanctions should not be allowed to derail talks around the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
I hope that this can be kept separated because the JCPOA negotiations, of course, it has a long history already, and I would say it's this close that we could get an agreement on JCPOA.
During a debate on human rights in the European Parliament a few days ago, the EU was accused of displaying double standards.
Europe has invaded and butchered millions, plundered and committed genocide, overthrown and murdered revolutionaries, backed brutal dictators, imposed murderous sanctions.
Amid growing economic turmoil in the EU, many experts claim sanctions against Russia have backfired. In other words, sanctions don't work. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A high-ranking Venezuelan delegation is in Tehran to take part in a joint economic meeting with the Islamic Republic. the purpose of the commission is to deepen cooperation in strategic areas as part of a 20-year agreement signed between the two countries.
This is the 9th Joint Economic Commission, and as you know, representatives from both sides have identified potential areas of cooperation in different fields, including transportation, industries, agriculture, energy, science, and technology. We will be trying to find ways to facilitate trade between the two countries to boost bilateral relations in order to avert the consequences of U.S. sanctions.
The Islamic Republic of Iran and Venezuela are two independent states that share common views about many regional and international issues, such as seeking independence, the right to self-determination, and a multipolar world order.
Nosotros lo que estamos mostrando es
We care about the well-being of our nations. Our values are different from imperialistic countries. Now that our people and our governments are united, we can avert the U.S. sanctions and allow out countries to prosper through bilateral cooperation and a strong political and economic ties.
Part of our scientific cooperation and training includes ways to advance new trends in molecular biology, biotechnology, and proteomics for cancer treatment.
In Venezuela, we have been testing regenerative agriculture in order to avoid desertification. We have achieved excellent results, and now we are ready to share our experiences with Iran.
Iran and Venezuela signed a 20-year cooperation roadmap during a state visit by President Nicolas Maduro to Tehran in June 2022 as the two oil-rich countries sanctioned by the U.S. pledged to boost bilateral ties. The 9th Joint Economic Commission of Iran and Venezuela will be going on for another 3 days. It is expected to pave the way for implementing the cooperation agreements signed between the two countries in different fields. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country. But on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Last winter was devastating for many Afghans, especially internally displaced families. Some lost their loved ones, while some were forced to sell their children and body organs to make ends meet. Yet this year, the UN Refugee Agency warns that the coming winter will even be more deadly and challenging for displaced people. According to the UN body, 79% of Afghans do not have adequate access to heating, and 79% households live in shelters that require repair. We are visiting a refugee camp in Kabul, where the people are struggling amid the looming cold season.
People here are facing many challenges. Neither the previous government nor the Islamic Emirate has taken any steps to address them. I know families here who are on the brink of starvation. They can't afford basic needs and struggle to survive. I wonder why the aid organizations are not reaching out to these families.
A woman who fled her house in Helmand during the U.S. war now lives in a cold shack, facing dire conditions. She says she uses plastic and paper wastes for cooking.
Look, I have no clothes, carpet, food, or home necessities. During the day, I have water with dried bread, even though I'm unable to chew. Look, this is my house. Its roof is so weak and perilous. Swear to God, I'm suffering so much and facing numerous shortages. I don't know what to do. No one listens to us and no one hears our calls.
Some 3.4 million Afghans are currently internally displaced, with the majority of them living in such temporary shelters. Some of these people say the war forced them to flee their homes, and therefore the United States is responsible to address their needs.
Indeed, the U.S. caused these sufferings and miseries. It's war in Afghanistan that killed and displaced people and widowed thousands of women. As a result, nearly 11,000 families have taken refuge in this camp. Today, it is their responsibility to help ease the lives of the war victims. The global community should help these people with relief aid, shelter and protection.
Despite worsening humanitarian needs, the funding outlook for life-saving aid programs and assistance remains bleak, according to the UNHCR. People here are expected to have a tough winter. They're worried that they may run out of fuel if the global community fails to address their needs. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Yemeni Ministry of Health and Population held a press conference in Sana'a to highlight the impact of the continued Saudi siege on the national drug supply program. The event took place amid a severe shortage of necessary medication in the war-torn country.
The Saudi blockade imposed on the national drug supply program has caused one of the world's worst crises in the health sector. Medicines do not arrive on time at all due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport, which has also led to a high rate of death among people with chronic diseases. Patients can't receive basic drugs such as insulin for diabetics, and this is a tragedy no one talks about.
The ministry says almost 169,000 patients cannot receive life-saving medicine and they are in real danger unless the siege is lifted.
The pharmaceutical system in Yemen has been gripped by the Saudi blockade. International companies have partially or completely left the Yemeni market as they face extra costs as well as seizure of vessels for weeks and months. Moreover, medicines should be delivered in special conditions to maintain their quality and effectiveness. The fuel crisis has also negatively affected the shipment of medication.
Earlier, the member of the National Negotiating Delegation, Abdul Malik Al-Ajri, accused Western powers of preventing the entry of medical supplies into Yemen, saying this precedent has never been witnessed throughout history.
Officials believe that Saudi Arabia is deliberately preventing medical supplies from entering Yemen to pressure Sana'a to accept the UN agreement as it is. They say the siege has failed throughout 7 years of the war, and the kingdom's measures will push the Yemeni army to carry out new air strikes.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The notorious Guantanamo Bay prison is a stain on the human rights record of the U.S. 20 years on, and this prison still stands as the symbol of the most disgraceful human rights abuses in the world. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Global Times wrote, on January 11, 2002, the U.S. military began detailing captives of its global so-called war on terror at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, starting one of the longest and darkest chapters of its abusive treatment of suspects. In the years to come, hundreds of foreign Muslim men and even boys would be secretly detained, denied due process, and subjected to physical and psychological abuses, some of which amount to torture. According to New York Times, as of July 2022, the U.S. has imprisoned 780 men and boys at Guantanamo since 9/11, many of whom were later determined to have little or no connection with Al-Qaeda. Nine have died at the facility. Although President Obama ordered its close within 1 year in 2009, 36 remain detained. Since the beginning, Guantanamo has been an arrangement that aims to circumvent both domestic and international legal supervision. To start with, a detention site located at a U.S. Navy base on foreign soil provides the convenience of complete U.S. jurisdiction and control while avoiding the unpleasantness of any domestic legal oversight. Back then, the Bush administration labeled detainees there as unlawful combatants, a newly coined term, rather than the traditional prisoners of war. This labeling tactic gives the U.S. discretion to decide how these detainees would be treated. Because the U.S., one of the 196 states that have ratified the Geneva Conventions of 1949, is bound to guarantee POWs a minimum standard of care, including safe accommodation, adequate food and medical attention, as well as immediate release and repatriation after the cessation of active hostilities. States are required by these conventions to offer the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, access to detainees and prohibited from exposing POWs to violence, torture, or cruel treatment. Unlawful combatants, a term undefined in the Geneva Conventions or any other treaties, are therefore not guaranteed the above-mentioned legal protection. With the authorization of the U.S. administration and the military, the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, later created and subjected numerous detainees to the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, such as beating, sleep and food deprivation, extreme noise, isolation, severe cold, sexual humiliation, stress position, mock drowning, waterboarding and walling. For over two decades, Guantanamo Bay has been at the center of controversy. It stands as a haunting moment of human rights violations by the U.S. on the grounds of national security. Through Guantanamo, the U.S. suggests to the world that it is acceptable to sideline human rights and humane treatment of detainees in the name of countering terrorism. More than two decades on, many in the U.S. still know little of the details of the systematic abuses carried out by the CIA and U.S. military against these foreign people for reasons. To start off, successive U.S. administrations have connived at these wrongdoings and chosen to cover up this moral low ground in its so-called war on terror. Only people cleared by the Pentagon can fly to the heavily guarded base. Proceedings from Guantanamo's military commissions, a flawed system to persecute prisoners at the base, have never been publicly broadcast. And transparency requests from media and activist groups have been resisted on the grounds that non-public information is classified. The Bush administration tried to block federal courts from reviewing Guantanamo cases. In the face of mounting domestic pressure, the Obama administration reviewed the legal status of each detainee but concluded that the detainees could continue to be held under the laws of war and not treated as POWs. In 2014, the Senate Intelligence Committee only released a heavily redacted summary of its 2014 report on the CIA torture program. The current administration has no intention to release the full Senate report, much less criminally investigate those responsible for creating, authorizing, or implementing the CIA's secret detention and torture program. Like the previous ones, it also opposes allowing the International Criminal Court to include abuses by U.S. nationals in its investigation on grave human rights crimes in Afghanistan. Besides, popular culture in the U.S. has often soft-pedaled and glorified the cruelty and failure of these measures. For example, the 2012 Hollywood blockbuster movie Zero Dark Thirty and the 2019 interrogation exhibit at the International Spy Museum in Washington trivialized the abuses inflicted on suspects and went so far as to suggest erroneously that torture worked. Guantanamo is hardly the only scourge from the U.S. so-called War on Terror. Its counterterrorism campaign has spread to 85 countries with scant transparency or oversight. Brown University's Cost of War project found out that with the participation of U.S. allies, the CIA secretly and extrajudicially transferred at least 119 foreign Muslims from one foreign country to another for incommunicado detention and harsh interrogation to various CIA black sites. The U.S. military also held thousands of foreign Muslim security detainees and POWs, including women and boys, at its detention centers abroad, including Abu Ghraib in Iraq and Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, subjected many to physical and psychological abuse, and denied them access to lawyers and right to challenge the basis for their imprisonment. Despite the controversy, the U.S. has continued its cruel and inhumane practices against terrorism suspects to this day, transferring them to U.S.-run sites overseas where they are subject to torture. It is deeply disheartening to see a country that has been so central to the drafting of core international human rights instruments breaking its commitments. Before Guantanamo turns 21, bold steps need to be taken to reverse the course. Truth needs to be told. Justice needs to be upheld. Wrongs need to be made right. Those responsible for terrorist attacks must be held accountable to law and serve their terms properly to atone for their crimes. So are those who have incarcerated, tortured, and killed innocent men and women, boys and girls, in the name of countering terrorism. Also, New York Times wrote, at millions per detainee, Guantanamo prison stuck in a cycle of costly delays. More than 20 years have passed since the George W. Bush administration brought the first detainees to this remote outpost in southeast Cuba 4 months after the attacks of September 11, 2001. It was a makeshift temporary mission and it is still being run that way. Expeditionary style, as the military calls it. Over the years, the Guantanamo prison has cost $7 billion and has housed 780 detainees and tens of thousands of troops on mostly year-long or shorter tours of duty. Even now, with just 36 detainees at the prison, each costs $13 million a year. When a brigadier general from the Michigan National Guards becomes the 21st commander later this year, he will inherit many of the same challenges as those who commanded before him. Moldy, unsafe buildings, an outsized prison staff, and ailing, aging detainees, some still suffering the consequences of torture in CIA prisons 2 decades ago.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kaba Tafway. Many EU countries have announced their intention to increase their military spending. Such increases are estimated to be around 200 billion euros for the next few years. It's under an initiative called the European Defense Investment Program, which the EU has said is to deepen cooperation between EU countries as well as with their NATO partners. Why not come up with a program that will help their citizens who are suffering from high energy costs and incomes that can't keep up with inflation? Just a few of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight.
In just the past 9 months, the EU and US have together pumped 32 billion euro worth of lethal weapons into Ukraine. At a meeting here in Brussels on Tuesday, EU defence ministers agreed to increase their military spending by a huge amount between now and the end of 2025.
70 billion euros.
Apparently, there is an urgent need to replace weapons being sent to Ukraine.
The supply of arms to Ukraine, it's a continuous flow. It flows every day. And every day there is a member state who provides more. The system has already been provided. I don't think we need new systems. What they need is ammunition to make the systems work.
One expert we interviewed online told us it is a dangerous policy.
The problem with further funding is that it suggests further escalation. An escalation is hazardous because by intent or by miscalculation, it can lead all of the parties into a nuclear conflict.
Many peace activists and rights groups say the military spending is grotesque given the EU's growing social crisis. Those in the European Parliament who oppose NATO and are calling for peace talks between Russia and Ukraine are furious at attempts to silence them.
We talk about democracy, but where is this going to end up? Those you brand as populist and anti-European have a democratic right to disagree with you on the course that Europe is taking.
Defence ministers have agreed to establish camps in up to 20 EU nations that will be used to train Ukrainian soldiers. Some security analysts are suggesting long-standing, controversial ambitions to create an EU army within the EU have effectively been put on hold. And now the strategy is to create an EU army in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Don DeBar joins us. He's an activist and commentator who joins us from Ossining in New York. Also joining us, John Busnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, who joins us from Novi Sad in Serbia. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
John Busnich, first over to you. So we had a correspondent there in his report talk about how in the past 9 months the EU and the U.S. have pumped out 32 billion euros worth of lethal weapons into Ukraine. I'm guessing that's a very conservative figure because the figures actually point to a lot higher than that figure. But the point of the program is why do they keep increasing their military budget, of which the EU seems to think that that should be a necessity. Why do you think the focus from the EU especially is so much to increase their spending?
Well, this is a good opportunity for the military-industrial complex to make a real killing, not just in terms of on the battlefield, but financially. By increasing the amount of weapons that they can deliver to the battlefield in Ukraine, they are going to turn over the biggest profit in modern history in the military-industrial complex of the United States. That's the real aim here.
Well, digging deeper, Don DeBar, when we take a look at what is going on, there's a program of which the EU is not only to have contemplated, but is now is in its execution stage, where the increases in military spending is set to be, and I'm quoting this from the EU source, that it's estimated to be at around 200 billion euros for the next few years. It wouldn't say years, it just said few. That's an awful lot, isn't it?
John's right on the one hand. The problem is you have these things that are sort of like dual purpose, means and end. It's like a self-financing casino. You pay yourself a lot of taxpayers' money to build weapons. You take the weapons and you go steal somebody else's stuff. As things get blown up, you steal the money that you have in your banks of the people on the other end who you're bombing, and you apply that to this mega thing, whatever the hell it is, also, and it just feeds. It feeds. And in essence, it is the deepening of exploitation of all of the world, of the resources of the world, by the elite that has been doing that in Europe and the United States for centuries now. It's globalized. When they were talking about building a global order, we're seeing sort of the tail end of it. The parts that they have not absorbed and eaten and digested yet, they're making a grab for now. They're reaching across the table. So they stole your fork and they picked your pocket while they did it. And they're going to use it to whip the steak off of your plate, and they're going to eat that, and then your plate, and then you. That's the game.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what's interesting, John Bosnich. Maybe you can explain this to us. So on the one hand, you have the NATO, who has a budget where it commits a minimum of 2% or asks the member countries to contribute a minimum of 2% of their gross domestic product to what they call defense spending. We call it military spending. And then they say the purpose is to ensure the alliance's military readiness. Okay, so you have that, and then you have the EU now, who are now committed to, what, $200 billion in the name of the program, which is a little bit down the list here. So am I to understand, or are we to understand, that EU has to contribute to their own military spending and to the NATO military spending?
Well, this is the intent here is not just to get the EU to contribute. The intent is also to indebt the country of Ukraine and to charge interest on that debt. So this involves not just the military-industrial complex, but it also involves the banking industry of the West, which is going to get the Ukrainian people, no matter what happens in this conflict, to pay back all of this money plus interest. So we have a combination of the worst elements of the Western world, which are the military-industrial complex and the people that are commonly called in America the banksters. These two combined are going to crush the Ukrainian people regardless of what happens on the battlefield.
Well, I mean, crushing the Ukrainian people is one thing. What you said obviously makes sense. But Don DeBar, when you take a look at the GDP of NATO, I was shocked to see the figure. I had to double check it, but seems to be accurate. $32.4 trillion, the total GDP of NATO nations. That equals 45% of the world economy. So my question is, well, this can go to better use, can't it? Especially when you talk about the EU, for example. I mean, if you, I could show you a snapshot of a guy in Germany who's breaking down lumber for a cold winter.
Across Europe. The guy in Germany is lucky that there's wood to work on. Some people where there's not, you don't have as much, you don't have any forest left or whatever, there's nothing to burn but the furniture. The problem is, first of all, Europe is sort of a repository, as is the U.S., but Europe particularly, for wealth that was accumulated, basically stolen from around the world. It's one of the wealthiest pieces of real estate on the planet. That wealth is held generally in private hands, although there's a good amount of it that's been socialized, and you can see that in the infrastructure and the expectations generally of the population there that have sort of been fed over the years, over the centuries even. The idea that Europe would have its own military again has been floated on and off for a number of years. And depending on the administrations in the United States lately, there's actually been a shift in opinion back and forth by the U.S. on how that should happen. Trump, as you'll recall, was not so up on NATO, had mentioned that perhaps it was obsolete, then mentioned that certainly countries like Germany that had such a high GDP and per capita, were wealthy, shouldn't be subsidized in terms of their own militaries by U.S. taxpayers. Of course, the people in Europe for the last 45 years now, maybe longer, have been suffering austerity imposed by their governments, and this has been aggregating over the 4 or 5 decades. And so the imposition of an additional tax on them for this your own share of NATO expense, without what's happened, would have produced something like we're seeing in the capitals now, where people are marching against NATO, they're marching against the war, they're marching against austerity, and they're marching against the perception of their governments as being anti-democratic, that perception rising basically from the fact that their governments are doing one thing and they're demanding from their governments something else that they're not getting. So, we're looking at a situation that's not sustainable on its face as far as that goes. And we're looking at a situation also in terms of the military where we're starting to see a little element of chaos enter. Hungary, Turkey, and others are starting to break away from this monolith that people thought they, you know, that existed.
What did you think about the protests in Europe? I mean, you know, it's covered here and there when it is covered, but it's just pinpoints to a country, let's say Italy, and it shows the protests, and then it gets mixed in with other news. But if you take a look in the past 7 to 10 days, Don DeBar, these protests are huge in numbers. Italy, Spain, you have Germany, you have, I think, Hungary was one of them. There's a number of European countries, and they're large numbers. France. It looks like it's sweeping European nations. Shouldn't the governments be worried?
I think it depends on why they would worry. In other words, should the governments consider the possibility that they could be deposed? And I say the possibility exists. We haven't really seen a full manifestation of the thing that's happened yet. You know, the price of energy, you know, tripling or doubling or whatever, depending on where you are in Europe, is one thing when you have to postpone your summer vacation or, you know, somehow tamp it down, driving somewhere instead of taking an airplane, whatever. It's quite another when you are in your house freezing and you can't turn the heat on because it's been shut off or you can't afford to pay for the next payment to have heat. At that point in time, people's concerns about this rise from, you know, political discomfort to the level more of this is an existential threat that we have to remedy right away. And so I think as conditions deteriorate further in Europe, you're going to see what we're seeing right now as more or less a prototype of what's to come, real energy pumped into that. And I think you'll see, if not revolutions, certainly some governmental turnovers that are not the usual, Labor's going to come in or Tories or whatever mode, but rather something much more directed from below.
7 or 8 months ago, I think 9 months now, John Busnish, when this war with Ukraine started, the stats on the EU in terms of poverty was quite alarming. Again, a surprise. Over one-fifth, 22.5% of the EU population living in households with dependent children who are at risk of poverty. That's 73.7 million people that are at risk of poverty. Again, 9 months ago when we came into this war. And then you have this news about the EU spending so much money on their spending. We just talked about the protests with Don DeBar that are happening across a number of EU countries. What are the governments missing in this picture before the storm actually hits? Because as it looks like, the storm has already hit.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to do away with the concept that the governments actually care about their people. The governments care about the people only when the people complain. And so far, the level of complaints has not been high enough to put any pressure on the governments to stop this, because the governments basically control a media monopoly across the entire EU, backed up by the American media monopoly controlled by the Washington government. So the people may protest, but the amount of coverage that those protests get on the mainstream media is restricted as much as the governments can get away with. What we're going to see, however, now as winter sets in, is that there's going to be a real decrease in the quality of living of people who cannot heat their homes, who cannot feed their families, and cannot survive at a level that is minimally acceptable to the majority of the people. Once you hit that level, you're going to see a situation in which the protests, if they materialize as expected, cannot be controlled by the governments. And especially around Christmas time in the West, if people are protesting at Christmas, we're going to be seeing a series of events that we simply cannot imagine in the Western economies.
Like
and
what?
That is going to have a real effect.
What do you mean, series of events? Like what?
Well, if people are unable to have their Christmas holidays in the traditional fashion in most of Western Europe and in America, you're going to see the potential of people on Christmas Day out in the streets protesting. And that is something we have not seen in the Western world since the Vietnam War.
Interesting. Okay. It's not that far away, is it? Well, let's take a look at statements made by the EU Foreign Policy Chief, Josep Borrell, Don DeBar. And this happened at a speech at the 2022 Ambassadors Conference in Brussels, October the 10th, not that far back. He said that the U.S. is not a reliable partner for security, and that Europe's security policy was based on the U.S. and NATO, that the EU had delegated our security to the United States. And he says that that's wrong. What would make him say that, do you think?
You know, there are a lot of contradictions, both among the members of NATO, you know, the EU members, and also within those member nations, political contradictions. The glaring contradiction, of course, that you have, you see reproduced across the scale in Germany. He's one example, and the foreign minister, Baerbock, is another, where they've, in essence, said, yeah, we know the German people were promised that we would deal with this austerity thing, and we know that you're having a hard time, and we know that what we're doing now in the war with Ukraine is making it even worse, and we had promised to make it better, but we made a promise to Ukraine also, and that's the one we're going to keep. There's, in other words, a contradiction between the government officials and the people that is creating on behalf of the people, when energized by this sense of an actual fact of desperation, a condition that hasn't existed before, that is going to hold out basically a very limited set of solutions, either to endure the situation until the people collapse or to throw off the government structures that are imposing this on them and remedying the problems they face. There have been a variety of mechanisms for blowing air into the system in the face of these intrinsic contradictions that exist in the economies and the political economy of Europe and the United States and the Western countries in general, from Keynesian economics to, you know, a variety of different social programs and things, safety net, et cetera, that have all pretty much been exhausted and swept aside. The need, meanwhile, for the monster to feed only has increased. Its appetite has increased, and you come to a point where there's no solution within the existing set of rules. Where you have to throw the pieces off the game board, and sit down and figure out where you are and start over. And I think, again, the two paths are either the people are going to collapse under the weight of their own impoverishment, or they're going to throw off the mechanisms that are imposing this on them that remedy the situation. We're going to see that play out in a lot of places in Europe this winter, I'm convinced.
Sure. Well, the fact that Europe can make its mind up when it comes to the U.S. on the subject of military operations and spending, John Bosnich, is alarming. I mean, on the one hand, you have Joseph Borrell that says the U.S. is not a reliable security partner, but then he says the U.S. and the EU are closer than ever. However, that alliance is not ironclad, and it could shift in the near future. What do you make of the schism here, of the contradiction, I should say?
Well, I think that the man is suffering from a split personality. And unfortunately, he shouldn't be in political office if he's having that kind of a problem. First of all, the underlying most important point is that Europe, especially the EU, is a militarily occupied colony of the United States. All economic activity in Europe is dependent on the U.S. security blanket. And now when the U.S. has succeeded, along with England, in scuttling the economy of the EU, what we've got is a situation where the EU is just being used as cannon fodder for the United States. And I think that when you combine these factors, we're going to see a situation in not just the people of the EU, but several of the governments of the EU may be reconsidering their membership in the EU and even their alliance with NATO. What has happened is NATO has provoked this war, the U.S. State Department has provoked this conflict, and they've pushed the EU countries first into the fire. And the EU countries cannot be expected, especially countries like Poland, Hungary, and Romania, which are frontline countries on the front next to the war zone, cannot be expected to stand idly by while America pushes them forward and keeps itself far away from the conflict. This is the dangerous structural problem at hand today.
Well, the U.S. is not happy when it hears about what's called this European army or European military force, Don DeBar. This is something that has come up not just recently. It's propped up years and years and years ago. And it basically puts American officials in a state of I don't want to say panic, but worry, because they think that if Europe gains its strategic autonomy, so to speak, then it's not going to follow the U.S. In terms of any foreign policy objectives that it may have, which would run, obviously, to America's interests. Are we looking at the Ukraine war as something that the U.S. is leading to make sure that EU is going to follow U.S.'s lead here, so it could keep it subservient to it? Is that what we're looking at?
I think we begin with the point John made that's a very important point, which is a statement of fact, okay, that Europe, among other places, Korea, Japan, et cetera, is still militarily occupied by the United States and has been since 1945. I think the answer to your question, the key to the answer to your question, is to take a look at Germany post-war, when you had the four occupation zones, the UK, France, the US, and the USSR, divided Germany into four parts. And then, in violation of the agreement on how to operate going forward, the idea was to keep Germany split up into pieces so it couldn't make mischief anymore. And if Germany couldn't make mischief anymore, then Germany couldn't ally and or acquire other, you know, powerful states in Europe and make mischief on a global scale anymore.
Sure.
And so in violation of that agreement, within only a few years, UK, France, and the U.S., with the U.K. and France pretty much being occupied by the U.S. at this time also, decided to merge their three into the Federal Republic of Germany, which became about two to two and a half times in size and whatever as Eastern Germany, and redeveloped it and Western Europe. Right. And the USSR is the only one that walked away.
Okay.
After occupying Eastern Europe to protect itself from another invasion, walked away from its share of Germany in 1989, and then from those other states that now are part of NATO that have moved up to Russia's borders. The U.S. sees the example of the USSR having ended its military occupation as enabling others to fill the void, and the U.S. willingly did that.
Thank you for that.
And
thank
obviously
you.
Knows if it leaves Europe, that this European army would be a threat, perhaps. Instead, the way it is, European army would only
all right,
be an adjunct.
I got to unfortunately jump in, Don DeBar. I'm so sorry. We're just out of time. The activist and commentator from Austin. Thank you, Don DeBar. John Busnich, thank you. Journalist, activist, and political analyst from Serbia. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tatlevi. It's goodbye.